Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 3:19 p.m. That is Central Time. Today is September 22nd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, in this broadcast, what I would like to focus on is the efforts that China has underway to try and support their economy and some of the roadblocks that they have in front of them. Then also looking at the efforts that several other countries have in attempting to try and get inflation under control and what the possible repercussions of that are. Then I think it's also important to realize that one of the primary attributes of crowd behavior is the tolerance of contradiction. And every big market has an internal contradiction because it's usually the acceptance of the contradiction contributes to excesses. And it is usually by the time you get to the peak, it's when the contradiction is glaring and it eventually contributes to the subsequent decline and dissolution of the crowd. So we get that in every big major market. And you can just simply go back and think about all of the major bull markets we've had over the last several decades. So in 1999, it was very well publicized that earnings don't matter. And obviously they do. But that didn't stop people from bidding up technology, media, and telecom companies to extraordinary heights. But then, of course, earnings do matter. And those shares, many of them disappeared, lots went down, and it turned into an enormous crash. In 2007, there was the advent of credit derivatives. There were collateralized loan obligations, collateralized mortgage obligations. And then there were CLOs on CLOs, there were CLOs on CMOs. And there were such incredibly complicated structures that it was very difficult to understand exactly what was being levered. But the whole thing was being based upon the assumption that now it was possible to hedge default risk, and therefore everybody would be able to hedge their default risk, and nobody would really have to take that risk any longer. And of course, what we subsequently found out is that yes, some people can hedge, but not everybody gets to hedge. And that eventually that contributed to a massive financial crisis. Well, now we're in another interesting environment. So China has been in a contradictory type of environment for quite some time. And obviously, when you have a very clear focus on politics versus markets, then eventually that will come to bear on the performance of those markets. And that's basically what we're seeing right now, that the decade since Xi Jinping has taken over has resulted in a great deal of uncertainty with the stock market. I think that the credit impulse chart for China tells us a lot of information. We can definitely see that in 2008, they really did pull out all the stops, and they had this incredible infusion of liquidity, and they basically bailed out the entire global economy. And then subsequently, they had round after round of additional stimulus. So after the big infusion in 2009, they took some of it out, but then by the time we got to 2012, through the middle of 13, they were putting the money back in. A slightly smaller peak in 2016, an equal peak in 2020. And then with the property market coming under significant duress over the last 12 months, and at the low back in 2021, there was a natural assumption that the Chinese government would open up the spigot once more and let liquidity flow back into the market with the issuance of additional credit. That has not happened. And instead, the credit impulse has been basically going sideways for 18 months. So it is reasonable then to consider that perhaps something really has changed. and that we are going to continue to see piecemeal efforts because the extent of leverage has gone up so incredibly over the last while. Well, then let's go back and think about what happened in 2010 and 11. There was a broad understanding, and I remember speaking about this at investment conferences back then. So this is not new news. It was well understood by the investment community as well as the Chinese themselves in 2010 and 11 that they had pretty much got to the point where they were getting the maximum amount of benefit from investing in infrastructure that was possible, and that subsequently it was not going to be, the return on capital deployed was not going to be as high. And there was a clear challenge in front of the Communist administration that they had to embrace the technology and labor-saving devices, productivity growth mechanisms, wholeheartedly, and they had to do whatever was necessary to greatly enhance the individual productive capacity of every single citizen. And even back then, the demographic wall was very clear in the distance. And at the time, there was some interest in new technology, and companies like Tencent and Alibaba did spectacularly well by mimicking the kinds of market activity that was evident in Silicon Valley and then attempting to improve upon it. And I would say in the fintech sector, WeChat is much more advanced than anything that is currently available in the Western world. And of course, that is because they were able to sidestep financial regulation. And I think it's the same thing with Alipay, that it and Financial was able to grow to really considerable heights because it was able to sidestep regulation. And that is the basic Silicon Valley business model. But what the Communist Party suddenly found was that this massive boom in social it was contributing to the kind of freedom of expression that they're not comfortable with, but most particularly, it wasn't particularly enhancing productive capacity. And I think the Western world has experienced that as well. We have not had a big boom in productive capacity with the advent of social media. In fact, we generally find ourselves spending a lot more time scrolling with certainly a dopamine hit every time you get a like, but that doesn't mean that you're being more productive. And you can only watch so many adorable cat videos before you come to realize that they're not all that different from one another. Well, then what China has done over certainly the last few years has been to clamp down on the social media sector, clamp down on gaming, clamp down on tutoring for profit, and then subsequently also invest heavily in the manufacturing capacity for batteries, manufacturing capacity for solar and wind, and then also has been very forthright in ensuring that there are export markets for those products. But that's the good news. At the other side of the ledger, they did not stop investing in property and infrastructure. So China also has built the largest high-speed railway. And I think it's a question whether that company will ever be profitable. And certainly the share is in a range, admittedly the lower side of the range right now, but they've got so much in the way of infrastructure that it really doesn't matter how many more trains they build, the incremental benefit isn't going to be nearly as high as the first one built. And now we get to the big contradiction that China has. The first thing I think, though, is I thought this was a really interesting chart from the Financial Times, and it helps to highlight the countries that always vote for China, and they benefit from foreign direct investment from China. And whenever they run into trouble, then China helps to bail them out. So you've got Pakistan and Egypt and Mongolia, but then you also have Malaysia, Uzbekistan, Ethiopia, Nigeria, Cambodia, Tajikistan, Laos, Sri Lanka. And then we also have Zimbabwe, Sierra Leone, and I'm afraid I can't read the other two. But that's an increasingly large number of votes. And of course, when you have votes in the UN, you can ensure that the kinds of things that you want passed get passed. And the thing that China most particularly wants is to have an active export market for its solar panels and its wind turbines and its electric vehicles and all those batteries. So the EU is beginning to push back on that. And there's a clear reason for that, and it has very little to do with the quality of the products that China is exporting, and much more to do with protectionism. The automotive sector is a very significant part of the European economy, and the last thing they want is a lot of new vehicles coming in at a substantially lower price. So what we're now starting to see is more focus on attempting to try and mitigate some of China's ability to export. But they have all of this manufacturing capacity. So obviously this then is going to be a little bit of a challenge. Now, I think that it is particularly important to look at what China does in terms of emissions. So, and this is where I think the clear contradiction is. China is far and away the biggest producer of lithium-ion batteries, solar panels, wind turbines. And at the same time, the emissions from coal have not peaked. In fact, they might have looked like they were peaking, and then they ramped higher. So the rest of the world is bending over backwards to try and stop emitting coal, and China is accelerating its use of coal. But that's simply coal. And then, of course, we have the additional point that, well, it's not just coal. Then that's not the only thing that emits carbon. So let's just look at carbon emissions. And we can see that Europe's carbon emissions peaked in 1980. The USA's peaked in the mid-2000s, and both are trending downwards. And China's have done nothing but rise. So the net effect now is that China emits twice as much carbon, or more than twice as much carbon as the USA does, and three times more than the EU does. While at the same time, manufacturing all of the machinery necessary for those countries to achieve their carbon emission goals. And this is obviously problematic. So China is able to ensure that it has low manufacturing costs for advanced pieces of machinery, and part of that is labor costs, and another part of it is low taxation and a clear effort to pioneer these types of technology. And then, of course, you have the fact that they have cheaper energy. And they have cheaper energy because they're burning a ton of coal. Well, why on earth, and I think it is only a matter of time before politicians turn around and say they're starting to export their cars into our market, and that is taking bread out of the mouths of our workers. So why on earth are we bending over backwards to achieve our carbon emissions when China's emissions are more than compensating for any effort that we put in, and they expect us to buy all of their export goods without deploying them themselves? And I think that is something that is going to become more of a factor the greater China's reliance is on trying to export batteries and cars and solar and wind. And I think this is one of the internal contradictions of the renewable energy market. The whole thing is built on carbon emissions. And this might, and the carbon emissions might not be where we live, but it is being fueled by China's ability to continue to build and to fuel its economy with coal. And of course, then you have the additional point that when we think about what Xi Jinping had to say at the G20, he said that China is an emerging economy and it always will be. And the reason that China is able to produce as much carbon or to have industrial fishing fleets that are emptying the Pacific of fish. Well, they can do that because they're an emerging economy and they don't have to abide by the same kinds of rules as the rest of the world. Well, I think that eventually that condition isn't going to wash, and that the rest of the world is going to have to say to China that if you do not abide by the rules of a developed country, well, it doesn't matter, we're going to treat you as if you are one anyway. And of course, that would be a major escalation of the trade war. But of course, it is getting to the heart of the main topic, where you have this conflict between major powers. And China has been able to exist and prosper in a gray area where there was a clear hope that they would move up the value chain, and every other country that has escaped the middle income trap has done so by embracing liberalism. And China is attempting to do it without embracing liberalism, rather the opposite. And in fact, what they're doing right now is doubling down. And they are attempting to enforce socialism and the absence of independent thought. And of course, that's also why they're policing social media. So I think that's a very important point. Now let's look at some of these markets. So when we think about the Chinese market, there is obviously an internal argument for investors. Are they willing to put money to work? Are they looking at the chart and saying, well, golly, back at the end of 2022, it was really oversold. So we got a good sized bounce. It went from 15 to 22,500. That's a 50% advance for a major index. And then subsequently, it's given up about half that. And today's upside key day reversal, that's at least a low of near-term significance. And if we get follow-through on the upside next week, well, then that will confirm a failed downside break below the 18,000 level, and we could easily see a rebound back up to test the sequence of lower rally highs or the region of the 200-day moving average. And it's simply a mark of just how eager investors are to jump in on any positive news on China that the ASX 200 in Australia was well off its low in here today. So that's also looking potentially at least like a failed break below the 7,000 level. And then New Zealand also initially sold off quite aggressively and also rebounded in a fairly emphatic fashion in here. And of course, the market has been coming into the region of a potential area of support around the 1,000-day moving average. So this is obviously then a this is another upside key reversal, and we have a very short-term oversold condition, and the index could easily put on another 500 points. And then it would be approaching the region of the 200-day moving average. The bet, of course, is that too much bad news has been priced into China, and instead of the market being worth 80% of its peak, or excuse me, having declined, or the property market having declined somewhat, that maybe it is not going to decline by 80%, maybe it's only going to decline by 70%, are that the continued willingness to issue piecemeal pieces of liquidity will be enough to forestall a property crash, and that potentially that Chinese demand will be somewhat better than expected. And then iron ore prices, I think, are the other big thing that people are watching, because the iron ore price has been really quite steady. So a little bit easier over the last couple of days, but certainly not breaking on the downside and holding around the or above the 100 level. Then we have copper prices, which pulled back violently yesterday, pulled or rebounded off the low, then had some initial strength in here today and weren't quite able to hold it. I'm very leery of this view that there's going to be a massive commodity bull market. I think for a commodity bull market, you need supply inelasticity meets rising demand. And everybody who is predicting a big commodity bull market is focused on the growing demand side of the equation. And they look at the promises that have been made around demand for renewables and for new solar panels, for new electric vehicles. And they look at how much copper, zinc, nickel, lead, and cobalt, lithium will be re required for those batteries. And then they look at mine capacity, the ability to build new mines, and they say, well, it's inevitable. There will have to be a phenomenally large bull market. Then we have to also then look at some of the downsides. If you have commodity prices doubling from where they are today, and we get copper going from $370 to $7, then what's going to happen to the price of the vehicle? And then if you think about China, China has a massive demand for copper. And a lot of that is around productive capacity and all of the batteries that they're producing. But then it's also about their infrastructure build. So if we go through a downsizing of China's property market, and a longer term consolidation of prices where there isn't a crash, and although I would not be willing to bet that there will not to I'm not going to talk in double negatives. I'm not betting that the risk of a property crash in China has been erased. In fact, I think there will be money to be made on that particular bet over the next several years. And all we're seeing right now is some steadier action in markets. What we need to see is the bazooka action from China, and I don't think they're going to do it. And that means that we're going to see property prices grind lower. And that is terrible for investor sentiment, and particularly consumer sentiment. Then China long four was in positive territory today, and it's at the lower side of its range, but it does look like it is going to go down further from here. So I think we're still in a very difficult environment. When we think about where are the epicenters of risk in the global market, China has got to be one of those. They massively inflated their total debt load. They're dealing with a significant issue in the property sector. The government is no longer market friendly. They're much more focused on global dominion, and they're spending as much money as is required on attempting to move up the value chain in semiconductors now. So, what we, one of the thing, I guess, let's just think about it this way. One of the great things about an economy that does well over a long period of time is continuity. And the democracies that do well are those that set a long-term strategy. And the long-term strategy is adhered to even after you've had a change of government. So there's a program for economic development that persists for a long period of time, and that governments then generally tend to focus on day-to-day issues and taxation issues or social issues. But when it comes to the growth of the economy, then they generally don't get that involved. Well, that also corresponds with a middle ground political system where there is not that much actual difference between the parties. What we have in an increasingly large number of countries is polarization. And the polarization of the political process means that that happy situation where long-term planning can be adhered to despite changes in government, that's a lot more difficult with political polarization. But what we also have, there's been this assumption in China that the Communist Party is immovable, that because you don't have the change of government, that you would not have changes in policy. But the problem right now is that they do need to change policy, that this outright focus on property development is no longer working, and they do need to move up the value chain. And they're spending a lot of money on semiconductors, but they are also heavily reliant on the rest of the world buying their products. And Mexico has overtaken China as the biggest exporter into the USA. And ASEAN is far and away the biggest exporter into the USA. Of course, China is also trading with lots of those countries. So they're in a very difficult position overall because they have two big customer bases that are competing with one another geopolitically. But I think this is also a challenge because you don't have the same kind of ability for continuity of policy. And in the USA, what that is contributing to is massive deficits. So the deficit spending is exploding on the upside. And when we think about the kind of environment that we have right now, it's really profound in terms of deficits. And I thought this was a really great long-term chart. So we can see that there were plenty of deficits, periods of deficit spending in the past, but they've always been associated with war. And then, of course, we had the big wars in the early part of the 20th century, so massive deficit spending. But then the problem here is that we've had this incredible deficit spending, despite the fact that there hasn't been a very significant war. Now, of course, there have been wars because the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq, they were extraordinarily expensive and nothing to really show for them, which is obviously problematic. And then, of course, we had the pandemic and a lot of panic around that, so that resulted in massive deficits as well. Now, I will say that this is the UK balance sheet because the UK has the longest the longest history. But this is exactly the same for the USA, that you've had these incredible deficits expanding. And of course, political polarization is not just a US phenomenon, it's growing in Europe as well. And political polarization within the UK was in, or there's plenty of evidence of that over the last decade. And we see that there are both fringe left and right wing parties that are growing in popularity right across Europe as well. So that is a recipe for deficit spending because the only thing that they can seem to agree on is more spending. Because in order to coalesce around the idea of fiscal restraint, then they would have to agree not to exploit populism and to blame one another for the fiscal restraint. And since they're all populist parties, well, there's none of them are going to do that. So it does basically mean that we should anticipate that deficit spending is probably going to be on the menu for a good long time. Now, as we think about the attempts to get inflation under control, well, I think it's particularly important that the yield curve spread is starting to push higher. Now, the point that I've been making successively for most of the last year is that there are three phases to the yield curve spread. And the first is the initial inversion. People worry because there's a long history of the inversion of the yield curve spread being a lead indicator for future recessions. And that is all true. But then markets start going up again, and markets react more to the efforts of the central bank to try and get inflation under control. And when they're finally doing something to get inflationary pressures under control, then the market goes up. And we've seen that, over the last 9 months, the market has gone up a lot. And the time to be particularly cautious about the lead indicator value of the yield curve is when it starts going up again. And when it moves back up through zero, that is generally the time when the Federal Reserve panics and then starts cutting interest rates aggressively. So the reason that the spread is going higher right now is because the 10-year yield is going up faster than the 2-year. Now, the 10-year pushed up to 4.5% yesterday and then paused a little in here today. But it is certainly beginning to move a bit faster now than the 2-year. So this is a part of the, I think, the broader pattern, that eventually the long end of the curve starts responding to inflationary pressures. And then that's when you start to see that inflation can become unhinged, that investors there, and when we think about what the Federal Reserve has been saying, and Jay Powell was speaking just this week. And one of the things that he says is that longer term inflation is well anchored. But if the 10-year is breaking on the upside and rising faster than the 2-year, well, what that helps to really emphasize is that perhaps inflation is not well anchored, and perhaps there will be a fear that it's going to become unhinged. And that is, I think, why we're going to continue to see the Federal Reserve raising interest rates in November. And then we're going to see what happens after that. And the big question, of course, is when will the knock-on effect of raising interest rates by 500 basis points in a year and a half come to hit the broader economy? And I think we're going to start to see some evidence of that in the home builders. So the home builders peaked in 2021 and then rocketed all the way back up to test the peaks just about 6 weeks ago. Now they're breaking down, so it's a new reaction low in here this week, and coming back to test the region of the 200-day moving average. So far this is a relatively similar consolidation, and if it finds support at the region of the 200-day moving average, then the trend is going to remain intact. However, I'll just tell you my own experience, and it's that we bought our home in May of 2021, and between then and now, it has almost doubled in value, at least according to Zillow. Well, let's just look at Zillow, and they're one of the primary purveyors of listings, and the share has now broken down through the 200-day moving average, and it is clearly rolling over. So I think that we're going to start to see house prices coming back down again. And when we think about what has been used as a very clear bullish phenomenon. Well, it's been that the household liquidity conditions have been really quite steady, and that the cash on offer for households might have deteriorated, but that it hasn't really affected the net worth because the value of the home has been so strong and the portfolios have been so strong. Well, I think that's a scurrilous argument because I can't spend money I don't have. And it's really the argument about whether someone is cash rich or asset rich. I'm only rich if I can sell the assets that I have and I can take them profitably. And if all my value is contained in my house and I sell my house, well, then where am I going to live? And the money that I can spend on a day-to-day basis, well, that's my cash. And if the availability of cash on hand is being constrained, well, then that is going to have a knock-on effect on the consumer. And I think when we look at some of the companies that rely on the consumer, well, Amazon is down in a dynamic manner this week. It has broken the sequence of higher reaction lows. This is a very clear downward dynamic. It suggests a peak of at least near-term significance and a process of consolidation overall. And then I just do pay attention to some of these online retailers like Etsy and eBay, and they're trending downwards. So that's not indicative of a lot of demand for consumer goods. And eBay is barely steady in the region of the 200-day moving average. Shopify has abandoned its fulfillment centers, and they are now really embarking on a, I think, it's a bid for survival by putting a Prime button on a Shopify website. Because if you are selling via Shopify, but you're fulfilling your goods through Amazon, how is that different from selling through Amazon? But the share is now rolling over, and this was a rather large downward dynamic in here today as well. So there is no doubt that these consumer-dependent companies are under duress. And then the ARK Innovations ETF, having broken on the upside 3 months ago, failed to sustain the upward break, and then has pulled back again in here today, which really helps to highlight the interest rate sensitivity of the market. And with yields pushing higher, this is taking a toll. But then also the very clear risk that we're looking at the potential for a type 3 long sleeper base in some of these highly speculative ventures. And then it, I think when you think about the appetite for selling shares, Arm having popped on the upside initially after listing, was it last Friday, has now returned to test the IPO level. And then Instacart came through, or I think they were looking to, they were definitely looking to build their book earlier this week. Let's see if we can get that share up. So it was in negative territory, I know, yesterday, and still lower in here today. Now, I think when you think about a company that is dependent on free cash available for consumers, there is none more so than Instacart. And I can only describe it as the laziness company, that if people aren't willing to go out and pick up their order from a supermarket or and then of course Uber, more than half their business these days is deliveries from restaurants. And Uber has turned a profit. They've basically cornered the market, but that's not stopping the share from declining. There was a downside Weekly key reversal 6 weeks ago. It has failed to break up to a new high last week and is coming down again now. So I think there is clear potential here that we're going to see some additional downside. And of course, it is heavily dependent on consumer demand. Now, free cash flow at least is 3.3 billion, and they have cash of about 5. So the debt isn't going to be a major issue. It's not like Uber is going to go bust immediately. I think a lot is going a lot of the potential for whether Uber will eventually go bust or not is going to be controlled by Google and Tesla, and whether they eventually do solve the autonomous vehicle question. At that point, Uber will be totally obsolete. Now, and I do think it's also worth just relating my own experience. I was getting an early flight home from San Francisco last week, and I was looking for a cab at 4 a.m. to go to the airport. I could not get a driver for either Uber or a Lyft, and eventually I had to get a taxi because taxis were working, and Uber and Lyft drivers were not working on a Saturday night at 4 a.m. Now, I would have thought that in normal circumstances, that is when the clubs let out. So you would think that there would be more people around, but I could not find a driver. And now we have the downward dynamic this week in Google. So it got all the way back up to test at the peak from back in late 2021, and this is the biggest downward dynamic we've seen in a while. So, when we think about the outlook for the technology sector, I do think that artificial intelligence is going to lead to a great deal of productivity growth. And I've definitely noticed that the accuracy of the transcripts that Substack has for these videos has improved considerably over the last 2 weeks. And I think it's because the AI is learning my voice patterns. My daughter's not very happy because now she's not allowed to write essays at home, and she has to write all of her English essays in class, which meant that she was going to school an hour earlier today to meet with her teacher so that she could have some extra time to write her essay. And I think that is certainly it's a great thing for the school that they're encouraging kids to, or they're ensuring kids are definitely learning how to write. But it's a reflection of how sensitive the education system is to the evolution of artificial intelligence. But it is a very impressive tool, and it will create demand for more semiconductors. But I do wonder whether that has been priced in. And Nvidia, having just exploded on the upside, has already come down from 500 to 400 and change. Now, it has not broken the sequence of higher reaction lows, but it's definitely lost momentum, and it's failing to sustain upward breaks. So there is obviously the potential here that we could get a massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend. I think these are very significant factors. Now, when we think about where the epicenter of risk is in the US market, well, certainly there are two potential sources of problems. The first is that the concentration of the market on 8 large companies, and more recently 7 large companies, is not great news. And the Fangman companies had broken on the upside earlier this year, having reversed what looked like a completed top formation. And now they're rolling over again. But they still represent 23.3% of the entire market cap of the NYSE. And that's an extraordinary feat for an index with thousands of shares. 7 are a quarter of it, or 8 or a quarter of it. And I think that is a situation that is unsustainable beyond the near term. Then, of course, we have the other potential risk here, which is that a lot of the A lot of innovation in the financial markets is really focused on avoiding regulation. And you can deploy lots of risky strategies, provided you don't have your regulator sitting over your shoulder and watching whatever you're doing. And the inability of the big investment banks to participate in prop trading created an opening for a lot of the hedge fund type operations, and then making markets was another thing that banks weren't allowed to do, so Citadel Securities took that over. But then we have the additional issues that pension funds could not prevail with interest rates at 0% and bond yields at such incredibly low levels. So what they basically did was put their money into illiquid assets. And they swore after the 2008 financial crisis that they wouldn't do that again. But with interest rates at zero, that's exactly what they have done. So we have gone through a decade where investing in private assets has been incredibly rewarding, and we're still in that situation right now. So when we think then about let me see, I do want to close that. I do apologize. When we think about where the potential problem is, I was at a meeting a year ago, and it became obvious that it was Goldman Sachs was managing the hedge book for about half of all the hedge funds in America. And the only asset class large enough that they put them into was commercial property. Now, of course, commercial property can be broken up into lots of different sectors. And, you know, there are hotels and shopping centers and data centers. And then, of course, you have offices. Well, data centers are very dependent on the success of startups. And data center owners are obviously dependent on lots of customers for their data centers. But then offices have been denuded. There's one of the guys on my tennis team. He was a commercial real estate agent, or I guess he still is. And well, he's thinking about looking for a new job because the bonuses that he had been able to rely on for years have evaporated, and he needs to feed his family. And it just is a testament to the fact that commercial property is in a really serious funk. If we think that there's a way to monitor that, well, maybe we should think about CBRE, so one of the big commercial real estate companies, and providing real estate services, and it is now rolling over. This is a well, it looks to me at least like a massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend in a period of write-on extension. And I think it is quite reasonable to anticipate that it will fully unwind the entire bull market, and that it could easily come back down to 50, it could come back down to 40. And that I think would be a base case for some of these encumbered commercial real estate areas. Now, what's particularly interesting is that the dollar index has been very firm. And it was in positive territory again in here today. So investors are willing to continue to bet on the dollar because they believe the Federal Reserve is going to continue raising rates until they get inflation under control. I think we're going to have a really significant data print at the end of this month. And it is core services, less housing. And Jay Powell made a big fuss at the press conference this week, talking about how volatile energy prices are, and that CPI came down a lot because oil came down a lot, and it's going to go up again because oil is going up again. But I think the more important point here is that the thing that is absolute core, which doesn't even include housing costs, is still holding the breakout. And this, I think, will be the primary measure of whether the Federal Reserve will cut rates or not. Now, I think eventually they're going to cut rates because the consumer is going to run into trouble, and they're already running out of deposits. Credit card usage is going up. Delinquencies are rising, and delinquencies on loans rather than houses are rising. And then you have legions, 40 million people are going to start paying back their student loans in October. So the hit to the consumer is on the way. But these inflation measures are lagging. And the Fed has said that they're data dependent, which means they're going to have to wait a while. And it means that we could easily see a deterioration in the economy. We're already starting to see a deterioration in the stock market. And the stock market is a real-time reflection of investor sentiment. Economic statistics are a lagging indicator by comparison with the stock market. So I think it is quite likely that this index is not going to break down in when it's updated at the end of the month, and that the Federal Reserve is going to have to continue to tighten. That will help to support the dollar in the short term. And that is also helping to support the constant maturity real yield. And it's up to 2% now. So this is a meaningful move, and I will just update the date to today. So, well, it's up to 2% on the close and hasn't been updated on the chart yet. But as long as this trend is going upwards, well, there's no urgency to buy gold. Now, gold prices are rock steady. They've been hovering here around the $1,900 area for the last 6 months, and this is within the context of a 3-year range. Now, we know that ranges are explosions waiting to happen, but the necessary conditions for a breakout in gold are a weaker dollar and positive real rates start the trend of real rates turning around. So when the Federal Reserve starts cutting interest rates, that is going to be bullish for gold. And it's also going to ignite a fire under the argument for why someone should be invested elsewhere. Now, if China is such a large risk, both markets, debt, and politically, then one should really be looking at other venues. So I think it's interesting that the more back history we look at, the more it looks like the yen is probably going to break on the upside. Now, there's a lot of speculation right now around whether the Bank of Japan will eventually raise interest rates. Now, they said today they're not going to do it. And I think Japan has a very clear agenda, and they're not talking a lot about it. And this is one of the great benefits of not having a had to deal with massive political polarization. It's one of the few countries that has not had to deal with political polarization. In fact, they've been very quiet about what their objectives are, and it seems to me to be quite clear. They're reindustrializing, and the shares that are doing best are certainly those that benefit from a weaker currency. So it's the big industrials. Then the insurance sector is also doing well. The banks have popped on the upside. And that is despite the fact that they haven't raised rates yet. But inflationary pressures are rising. And the Topix Banks Index is now accelerating up and out of what has been a phenomenally lengthy range. So this is a very clear base formation completion. And we're talking about values that are fractions of where they were back in the late 1980s. So markets can move a lot, and we will still be at a fraction of where we were back in the late 1980s. I think China is a major topic of conversation in Tokyo. They are very keenly aware of the fact that Russia and North Korea are exchanging weapons, people, and technology. And that is obviously not something that makes Tokyo feel secure. I think they will industrialize, they will militarize the economy, and they will attempt to be the counterbalance and the first of the major barrier islands encompassing China. And if that requires a weaker currency, so be it. If it means that the domestic economy has to experience inflation, well, then I think that will be something that people will have to deal with. And my own experience is going to factories in Japan and having them tell us that their productive capacity was full and they didn't want new customers. Well, we were flabbergasted going in there. And that is just an example of what a deflationary mindset really means. So when we think about where the potential is, then ex-US money, particularly on a hedged basis, that is something that is clearly moving towards Japan as a hedge. I think DXJ is really overbought, and I think there will be a significant buying opportunity if we move into a recessionary environment. And I think that Mexico is going to be a clear beneficiary of the reshoring trend. And it's been all currency that has contributed to the performance of the iShares MSCI Mexico ETF over the last year. But eventually, we'll see the stock market also prospering as a result of the foreign direct investment that is looking to really access a market outside the USA with labor and ample resources and transportation networks, and that's definitely going to be Mexico. And then the Vietnamese market, right next door to China, and none too happy about Chinese encroachments on its territory. So Mexico is going to be the one that's close to the USA. I think Vietnam will be the one that's closest to China that will pick up some of the flow of factories, and particularly from Chinese companies looking to access ex-US manufacturing sectors. And certainly, Vietnam is a major manufacturer of solar panels, for example. And I think then we have India. And India has a massive young population. They're in the middle of their credit cycle. Now, the stock market was down for 3 consecutive days this week, and this looks like quite a downward dynamic on the weekly chart, even. So it's a peak of at least near-term significance around the psychological 20,000 level. We could quite easily come back into the region of the 200-day moving average. I don't know how much the accusation that India was the assassin of the Sikh separatist in Canada. It's certainly a possibility, something that we can't just dismiss out of hand, even if there's no proof of it just yet. And the stock market pulling back, that is, I think, rather interesting because the rupee having broken down to a new low earlier this week was in positive territory in here today. So we're certainly seeing at least some action to steady the currency around this area. The times, though, when India does particularly well are those brief periods when the rupee is actually appreciating. But it's been holding out quite well against a background where the dollar has been very steady. Now, there's obviously a reticence to think that Europe can prosper in an environment where there's a war going on the border. But I think it's interesting to highlight that the Europe Stoxx 600, it ranged below 400 for approximately 21 years, and then subsequently broke out. And even during the big pullback last year, it held the breakout. So we might be in for a lengthier period of consolidation here, and we might see another drawdown towards the 400 level. But you don't have the valuation mismatch. And the big valuation expansion that we've seen in the USA over the last decade has been primarily focused in the technology sector. And I think that's why we see this underperformance of the. And I've seen this argument so many times that I think it's lost its power to convince that we've had this phenomenal bear market in commodities and that they have to go into a secular bull market. But that's not necessarily the case. When we think about the, I'm just trying to remember what my ticker is here. So if we look at this ratio of the NASDAQ to the CRB index, obviously it's gone down a lot. And then we should ask the simple question, has it gone down a lot? Because the NASDAQ went up a lot and commodities went down a lot. Is it because the NASDAQ went up a lot and commodities went sideways? Or is it simply that the NASDAQ went up a lot and just went up faster than the commodities did? Well, let's look at that CRB index because it certainly went up a lot between 2020 and 2022. It's just the NASDAQ went up more. And over the course of the last decade, it has primarily gone sideways. There's been a lot of back and forth, but the price today for the CRB is not all that far away from where it was in 2004. So primarily the commodity complex has gone sideways and technology has gone up a lot. So to me, at least, that ratio, it really tells me that its technology is massively overvalued. And on a relative basis, commodities would do well. But that doesn't mean that commodities have to be in a secular bull market. For a secular bull market, we need a new source of demand. And I think that renewable energy is just not it. And that the intermittent and the or I'm going to just distill the whole argument down that technology is about doing more with less. And intermittent energy is about doing less with more. And it's incredibly capital intensive. So it primarily needs exceptionally low interest rates for an exceptionally long period of time to make it work. And we have definitely seen an uptick in demand for uranium and uranium assets over the last few weeks. So the GlobalX uranium ETF has popped on the upside here. And I just think that this is a no-brainer, that if we want carbon-free, dependable, baseload electricity, we know how to do it. And the safety record is on par with anything else. And obviously, it has a bad record, and these things have tended to be expensive. But if the regulatory burden is streamlined, if the models that are being designed are not one-off, but rather that they are manufactured in a factory, then the cost goes down. And I think that the argument around this is similar to the one that SpaceX made. And basically, SpaceX, their whole business model was that it made no sense to blow up your primary asset every time you wanted to launch something. And if you could have a reusable rocket, then you could reduce your costs. And that's what they achieved. And I think that if we can build a mass-produced nuclear reactor and we can increase the volume, then that's going to reduce the cost. So then you get the carbon-free electricity, and that makes everything else work better. The greatest problem for the renewable energy sector today is that the entire electricity generation sector is dependent on fossil fuels, and you really need to solve that problem first before you can really focus on an energy transition. And I think nuclear with batteries makes a lot more sense than batteries with solar plus wind plus geothermal plus a standalone or immovable battery that can charge the transportation battery. I think that when we just attempt to deploy Occam's razor, we get a much more elegant answer. I think as we look out over the longer term, it is those Occam razor type solutions will prosper. And we are going to have a more volatile period over the next 6 months to a year. And the odds of a recession, I think, are very high. It's really only a question of magnitude, but valuations in the tech sector are exceptionally high. And we will see more of a move towards industrialization. It will be more along the lines of what's happening in Japan right now for other countries as well. And the geopolitical competition between China and the USA, it eased somewhat because they're going to start talking again. But it doesn't mean that the world can simply rely on cordial relations between the two big superpowers when both of them are acting as quickly as they can to try and ensure themselves against a full decoupling. And that means a lot of industrial production. I think if we're going to have a commodity bull market, it will be based upon industrial build-out rather than renewable energy build-out. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.